something that, you know, a lot of our community experience in relationships, particularly in those early years, you know, the first 5 years of going from being partners and lovers and friends to parents, is resentment. Resentful of one partner going out to work and one staying at home. Did you experience any of that as you two were shifting between who was more at work and who was more at home?
Maybe at first, because at first I had a job for a company, for an advertising agency. I managed to negotiate like 2 months off and then I went back, but then I was quite quickly made redundant. So then I ended up being at home as well. But I think definitely for that first bit when I went back to work, I do think Jenny was sort of resenting it. And I can feel that had that continued, it would have caused resentment for sure. And, you know, then that becomes like not necessarily about gender, but just to do with like who has got the office job and who works for themselves. You know, it's like if she had had an office job, we could have split parental leave and whatever. But I think it would have caused the same sort of issues for sure. I think maybe I would have been a little bit more, as I said before, aware and conscious of my role in going out. Like, did I need to stay for drinks with clients or should I just come home? Did I need to go to the gym in the morning or should I just do the morning so Jenny could sleep in? You know, being aware of those kind of things, I think I was possibly quite good at. But inevitably, one person waving goodbye in their nice clothes, heading off for a day in the real world, where the other one's there, like, you know, in a tracksuit covered in baby sick, just like, okay, see you later then. Like, no. I would have struggled it if it was the other way around, for sure.
Yeah, I found that really hard. I remember when Guy first went back to work, I found it the longest day. And I think he came home at 3 and it was still the longest day of my life. There's a brilliant chapter in the book about perfectionism and pressure. And it's something that I think about a lot because I am a complete recovering perfectionist. You know, through my 20s, I was unbelievably hard on myself. Nothing was good enough for me. You know, I had this raging critic. And I really noticed it in motherhood. It got really loud. It was almost unbearable at points, you know, feeling like such a failure and I wasn't good enough. And so I had to really learn to change that. And so I was so fascinated by you talking about queer perfectionism, because I'll be honest, it's something I'd never thought about.
Yeah. So Stu, my co-author, who sadly can't be here today, is really particularly good on this subject because I think he's naturally more of a perfectionist than me anyway. So in the book, we talk about how as queer parents, you feel an extra layer of judgment on you out and about in the world, especially I think as two dads. I do think it's specific to two dads or indeed single dads. So Stu gives an anecdote of doing his daughter's hair for school on her first day of school. And, you know, really, really thinking that all the mums would be like judging and think, oh, dads can't do hair. And so he was looking at all these YouTube videos and like did an amazing job and sent her into school with like perfect hair. And then just as she was getting to the gate of the school, looked at her and realized that her school shirt was all stained and she'd got like scuffed shoes. And he was just mortified because there's this sense that, you know, straight parents are looking at you and thinking, oh, you know, they're not as good as capable. They're missing something by not having a mum. And a lot of that is in one's own head, I think, you know, that is, again, talking about the things we carry, like gay shame is a very real thing that from whenever you start sort of realizing your sexuality as a gay person, you realize where that sits in relation to the quote unquote norm, and you feel a sense of shame about it, even if your family are the most sort of welcoming as mine were and sort of open-minded and accepting of it, there's still a sense that you are somehow causing a bit of a problem by being a bit different and not just being like everyone else. And, you know, the legacy of Section 28, not being able to talk about gay relationships in schools, you know, even the word gay, like it's something that, you know, you feel like you shouldn't say around children or it needs to whisper. There is all of this shame attached to queerness that even as adults and like fully realized, confident, successful human beings, that shame lives in you somehow and somewhere. And it does come out sometimes. And I think certainly for Stu, he talks about, you know, really feeling it when he's out and about with his kids. He's got 3 kids. At one point, all 3 kids are under 5. Like, you know, those kids are going to be loud. They're going to be rambunctious. They're going to be having fun. And if you're there thinking, oh my God, they're not behaving themselves, everybody's staring at me and thinking that I can't control my children because I'm a gay dad and they're missing their mom. And like, you know, that's going to really add to your stress of parenting. I have felt it to a certain degree. I think less so do I feel sort of judged by society, because I think as a mother or two mothers, like, we pass quite easily in the world. I don't think anybody sort of, I honestly think probably people see us together and just think we're friends or something, or like one of us is the nanny, which we actually had in Italy when we were getting in a cab and the taxi driver said to my wife something along the lines of, oh, are you the nanny then? And she was like, yeah, okay, I'm just going to go with this. So I think perfectionism is something probably all parents experience. But when you add the level of gay shame and you add the level of like feeling like you're being scrutinized by society who are making a judgment on whether or not you have a right to be a parent, you know, that adds a whole extra level of stress for sure.
How can straight parents support that? Like, what could we do?
That is a really nice question. I don't know that there is anything you can do beyond sort of changing the whole like nature of our heteronormative society. Like, I don't feel like it's on you to change that. I think maybe just being like aware of it and not being afraid to sort of ask the question or say, if, for example, there are two dads at the school gate and one of them is like worrying about the fact that their kid isn't making friends or whatever comes up, to just sort of reassure them that this is like, oh my God, that's so normal. Like, we do that too. And just sort of making them feel like their issues are ones that everybody shares and sort of bringing them into the fold. You know, like, I think there is this amazing community of mothers and of motherhood. And I think sometimes as gay dads, they can feel a little bit excluded from that. And everything about parenting is geared towards motherhood. You know, everything is approved by mums. And, you know, to think as a mum, how that might make you feel if you are a dad, to get the wet wipes through the post and it be like approved by mums, and to just feel like, oh, okay, your whole like role and responsibility is constantly being negated and minimized by society. So I think to sort of open things up and even kind of think about like your use of language, for example, like, is there a WhatsApp group that's called Mum's Group? Could it just be called Parents Group? A tiny thing, just changing the title of a WhatsApp group. This is not denying motherhood. This is not taking anything from mothers. It's just making it inclusive. So the gay dads that don't feel like they are the ones that have to ask for it to be changed, for them to be included. So being the one that makes the change without the queer person having to ask for it, I think is a really great thing that allies can do for us, for sure.
Exactly. It's those little things, those microaggressions. I don't know if it's an aggression, but those little micro things.
Definitely, that you might not even think about. Yeah.
Exactly. They really add up.
Yeah, they do. And if you're struggling as a gay dad, maybe you've just adopted a newborn and like everywhere you go, you're being like whacked in the face with motherhood and this being for mums. And it makes you feel like this is not for me. It's not for me at every turn. And you're having to deal with all of the general stuff about having a newborn and all of the sleepless nights and the stress and everything else. And then you're being told that, you know, you're somehow less than for being a dad and not a mum. You know, it adds up to making the experience quite draining. And I think being a little bit more inclusive is no bad thing.
And I wanted to ask about open conversations, both sort of with your children and with Stu's children and with children who might be in our children's classes at school. And so I don't know if this is in the book. Have you had those conversations about how your little girl came to be? And has Stu had the same?
Yeah, we both have. We would say, you know, have those conversations from pre-verbal, like make it normalized from the very beginning. So there's not a sort of big reveal moment where you're sitting down and you're having to sort of tell them something. I think my daughter has always known that she was conceived with a donor. We've used that word very freely around her. We don't want there to be any shame attached to the word. And likewise, Stu with adoption, that's not a word that they feel like they need to whisper or be like, oh, they're adopted, you know, at the school gates. He's very out and proud. The kids will say they're adopted. They're happy. They're proud to be adopted. It's a good thing. So I think really normalizing the language around things from a young age is super important. Books are great. I've written a picture book called My Magic Family, published by Puffin, which shows lots of different iterations of what a family is. It's like a really good way to start conversations. My daughter and I do a lot of role play. It's kind of like our dynamic, our parent-child dynamic anyway. I'm always having to like pretend to be different characters for her. Like just this morning, I was having to be the number 3 from Number Blocks in conversation with the number 12 from Number Blocks. And I had to get their voices just right. She made me go and like watch the episode to get their voices. So I'm like doing this whole role play thing. So role play and acting things out has been a big part of our relationship. So we act out a lot of scenarios. So sometimes I'll be another kid and I'll say to her, "You don't have a dad. That's weird." And then she'll be like, she's very good. Like she's very in it when we do a scene together. She'll be like, "Actually, I've got 2 mummies, and some people have 2 mummies, and some people have 2 dads." And you know, we'll play it out. And I think that's a really good grounding for then if she does actually encounter those sort of points of view in her life or at school or wherever. But definitely like talking openly when you play with kids as well, like just being like, "Oh, look, it's 2 mummies." If you're playing with like Sylvanians or whatever, just integrating those relationship dynamics into play is also a really good thing to do. I think it is on all of us to do that. It shouldn't just be the queer parents.
Hi, I'm Lauren.
And I'm Nicole. And if you enjoy this show, you will love our podcast, Self Care Club.
Every week, we trial a different form of self-care and report back on the results.
We've tried everything from cuddle therapy, setting boundaries, laughter yoga, and many more.
2 friends
who rarely agree on anything,
testing out the world of self-care so you don't have to.
We've even written a book dedicated to self-care practices that cost you nothing.
You can listen to Self Care Club wherever you get your podcasts.
Or to purchase our book, search Have You Tried This on Amazon.